Okay. So this is actually the first of a five-part series. And we've called it Legacy of Leaders, 10 Leadership Principles We Can Learn from Great Leaders. So the question we should begin with is, what exactly does Jewish leadership mean? What is that? It's rather an ambiguous term. Is it people who are Jewish who are in leadership roles? Because there are many Jewish people in leadership roles who maybe shouldn't be there. But there have been some great Jewish people in leadership roles, as we'll see. It can also mean, which is going to be a main focus of our program, leadership in a Jewish way, which could mean Jews in positions of leadership, but it can also possibly mean non-Jewish leaders who have maybe inculcated through various different ways Jewish ideas of how they actually lead. So it's going to be 10 principles we're going to do, and over a five-week period, that is, that's 10, carry the 5, and then 2, divided by 7, 2 each week. Does that work out right? Yes. Okay. So we're going to do 2 each week, and we're going to start with 2 today. So we're going to jump straight in at these. We'll start with a quick story. They say this story is about Ben-Gurion, David Ben-Gurion, the first ever Prime Minister of Israel. He's got a great airport. Named after him. And the story is, by the way, it didn't happen to him. I'm 99.9% sure. And I don't know if the story even happened yet. But it demonstrates a little bit of the idea we're going to be dealing with. And the story is told that he actually met the Prime Minister of China. And the Prime Minister of China was like almost laughing and scoffing at him. Like, you have it so easy. I am the Prime Minister of 1 billion people. And you're the Prime Minister of, 2 million back then? 2 million people? I got it tough. And the story goes that David Ben-Gurion looked back at him and said, no, you got it wrong. You are the Prime Minister of 1 billion people. I am the Prime Minister of 2 million Prime Ministers. There seems to be this trait that goes through our people, which pushes us, as we're going to see from the sources, and you can look at this sociologically, psychologically, anthropologically. I'm going to look at it spiritually as well, although those factors are very important. Sociologically, of why Jewish people seem to almost like move forward into the world of leadership. And we're going to try and learn from some of these great leaders some beautiful ideas. So let's probably begin at the beginning. And principle number one of the 10 principles of great Jewish leaders is the opening of Genesis. That's a great place to begin. Because the principle is leadership begins with taking responsibility. Leadership begins with taking responsibility. And we see a great difference between the opening of Genesis, Bereshis, and the book of Shemos, Exodus. You see, in the book of Genesis, there seems to be a lot of failure in this realm. And eventually humanity gets better, and it reaches a great point at the beginning of the second book of the five books of Moses, the book of Shemot, the book of Exodus. Let's have a look at that together. So obviously we open up with two people, Adam and Eve, and they have a certain problem. Hashem called out to them after they had sinned and eaten from the tree of good and evil, which would reveal a certain amount of knowledge which they were forbidden to have eaten. By the way, they were told they could eat whatever they want, but punked, they wanted that thing they weren't allowed to have. What that story is about is another discussion. But for now, let's take it as a given that they ate from that which they shouldn't have eaten. Okay? And God calls out to man and says, where are you? Now, just to cut into the dialogue for a moment, this is not a geographical question. Everyone agrees that God knows exactly where they were. It was a question of, where are you? What have you done? Right? It's also an opening of conversation, which we'll see is a very important aspect, that God was trying to make them fess up to what they had done. Straight away, the man said, this is Genesis chapter 3, verse 9 through 13, the woman you gave to be with me, who, by the way, he loved very, very much, okay, but right now he's blaming, she gave me of the tree and I ate. What's the first thing Adam does? He blames his wife. Blames his wife. Doesn't take responsibility for his actions. Maybe we'll do better with womankind. And so God turns around to Eve and says, Hashem, God said to Eve, what have you done? And the woman said, the serpent, it wasn't me.
It was a slave. What's everyone doing over here?
They're all pushing the blame. No one is taking responsibility for their failed actions. And this continues into the next generation. We know that we have someone called Cain and Abel, Cain and Hevel, we say in Hebrew. And we know they were in a field. And for one reason or another, Cain became jealous of his brother Abel, and he ends up killing him, right? The first murder that we see in history. And it says to Cain, where is your brother Abel? Now, once again, God knows where he is. Two possibilities. One is he's trying to help him to bring out the truth. But once again, he fails to take responsibility. And he says, I don't know. And look at the words. Very, very important words. I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? Am I my brother's keeper? He says. And it's left as a question. God doesn't turn around and say, yes, you are, by the way. Other than say, nah. He leaves us a question. So the commentators jump on this and like, why is it left as a question? Why didn't God answer him and say, actually, you are responsible to what happens to your brother, to your fellow man, your fellow woman. You are responsible. So there's a great Jewish commentator by the name of Rabbi Samuel Raphael Hirsch, who lived in the 1800s in Frankfurt on Main, one of the great Jewish leaders, who really turned around German Jewry, actually, in a great way. He gives an incredible answer to this one point. He says it had to be kept a question because to some degree it's rhetorical. In other words, am I my brother's keeper? And the answer is, we're not going to answer that. We're going to leave it as a question that's now going to have to pass down through history, Jewish and world history, and every generation is going to have to ask themselves, am I my brother's keeper? See, had he answered it, I think it would have been his answer and only him. But if you leave it open as a question, says Rabbi Hirsch, it remains a question that everyone has to ask themselves. And everyone's got to come to the answer, which is, yes, yes you are. But every time a new leader comes forward, a new person comes forward, they have to say, am I my brother's keeper? Am I responsible for other people? And he carries on, actually, not so well. We have someone called Noah, him of the great ark fame. And Noah had another challenge, right? The world was about to be destroyed. And people don't realize that Noah was a great, great and righteous person. Right? You shouldn't diss on Noah. However, he was lacking, the rabbis say, in one area. And that is what he was meant to do was, quote unquote, save the world. And the fact that he had that mission means that he was able to do it. He didn't fulfill that mission. For whatever reason, he was not up to par able to do it. And the end being that he himself was saved, and his wife, and kids, and their siblings, and their spouses. But he himself was not saved. The generation around him was not saved. And he was slightly culpable because he could have done something about it. And that carries on for another 10 generations until we meet Abraham, Avraham Avinu. And now, with the advent of Avraham Avinu, what we consider to be the first Jew, actually he wasn't, but the first real ancestor that we looked back to, him and his wife Sarah, suddenly things change. And Abraham and Noah are, in Jewish thought, they end up being compared to each other. And Abraham is someone whose essence was responsibility, not just to myself, but to other people. And Abraham is considered to be one of the great Jewish leaders. And his raison d'etre, you'll find one thing, there's a certain theme that goes with every Jewish leader. Does anyone know what his theme was? Chesed, kindness. That was his motto. That was his, I don't know his word, mantra, but you get the idea. That's how he lived. And that was the essence of his leadership. So compare that, which starts off not so good but gets much better, to the beginning of the second book of the Torah, of the Ba'abel, and that is the book of Exodus. And that's where we meet someone called Moshe Rabbeinu. Okay, now that, interesting enough, that wasn't his given name at birth. You're aware of that. Do you know how many names he had, by the way? He had 10 names. He had 10 different names. There's actually a dispute what the name he was given as birth, the main name. Some say it was Tov, some say it was Tuvia. You've heard of Tuvia before? So Moses, actually, that was his name, was Tuvia, was his real name. The word Moshe was actually given to him by the daughter of Pharaoh when she dragged him in his little floating cot device out of the water. And that's what the word means, to draw out. And remember, your name, not for now, but your name is your essence. And the essence of Moses and his leadership quality was that he was able to draw one thing out from another. So his name represented what actually happened to him. He was drawn out. And that's going to be the power of Moses. And there's three episodes we're going to see that really, when Moses took the initiative and took action. And they all happened. He was very, very young, by the way. And the three are, number one, he prevented injustice against the weak. Leadership quality within responsibility. Now, so we're in the world of responsibility. Number one, injustice towards the weak. Number two, he pursued peace. And number three, he helped strangers. And these all happened to him at a very young age, but all of them ended up helping form who he would become when he was much older. By the way, we're not very good and into young leaders. Right? Once you, like in American society, you think about retiring, you know, what, like 60, 65, you know? In Judaism, at that age, you're just starting. That's when it just gets going. Right, you're just beginning to get involved. Thank you. You're just beginning to get involved in the idea of leadership. Let's have a look at what he did that got him going. And maybe this is why he was chosen for this role as the leader of the Jewish people. Okay, and it says, first of all, the book of Exodus, and it came to pass in those days, Moses was grown up. Okay, that is, I don't believe that's a question of his physical growing up, but something happened to him, and he was in his teens, by the way, when this happened. And he'd grown up in the palace of Pharaoh, remember? And he went out to his brothers, and he saw their burdens, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. He's a Hebrew, he's not Jewish yet, because we're not the Jewish people yet, but he sees him hitting this descendant of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, right? And one of his brothers. And it says he turned this way and that way. There's a whole discussion what that is, by the way. But he thought. He took time to think about it. He saw there was no man, second page, ish. No one else was going to take responsibility. And he struck down the Egyptian, and he hit him in the sand. And he hit him in the sand. He killed the Egyptian, because he was attacking this Jew, the slave. He was about to kill him. He had to stop him. The only way to do it was to kill him. He kills him, he hides him in the sand. As a side point, just jump forward, because we have Passover in a couple of weeks, so it's going to be mentioned there as well. One of the plagues involved the sand. The lice. Moses was not allowed to begin that plague. His brother had to do it because it involved the sand, and the sand helped him, so he had to show gratitude to the sand. It's another discussion, maybe not for this course, that I may come up again. The idea of giving gratitude is actually a very important part, but we'll leave that aside. So that's number one. He helps injustice of the weak. Number two, he pursues peace. The next day, after he kills this Egyptian, it becomes a big story. People find out about it. And he sees two Hebrew men now, two Jews, are fighting. Okay? And he doesn't want that. He wants to pursue peace. And he said to one that did the wrong thing, he goes, why did you hit your fellow? So he turns around to him and says, who made you a leader over us? He gets in his face. And how do you judge us? And then he says, here's the kicker. So you want to kill me like you killed that Egyptian yesterday? Gives him a slap in the face. I mean, not literally, but metaphorically. Okay, and Moses was very, very frightened. And he said, indeed, the matter of my killing the Egyptian is known. And remember, it gets back to Pharaoh, he's going to want to kill me. It did get back to Pharaoh, and he has to escape for his life. And at that age, he leaves Egypt and doesn't come back for another 60 years or whatever till he comes back as an old man to eventually take the Jewish people out of Egypt. But he has to go and leave at that moment. Just interesting, why was he frightened? Why was he frightened? So the basic answer is he was frightened because Pharaoh's going to find out, he's going to want to kill him, and he's in big trouble. This is the person, you know, the leader of the country. So that he was very, very nervous and very, very frightened about. What else could it have been? So the other possibility, say the sages, is that they were speaking badly about each other. He knew that Lashon Hara, bad speech, was being spoken about. It got passed around that Moses had killed this Egyptian. It had become evident that he had done it. He had become very, very nervous. Because when people speak bad about each other, bad things happen. That is a general rule that we're going to see runs right through Jewish history from this point to the present day. And most of the bad things that have happened to us over time have resulted from Lashon Hara, bad speech. So that's a thing to keep in your mind. We'll be visiting speech as well. And Moses himself was a victim of his own bad speech. We're going to come to that a little bit later in another class. Finally, the third example, he helped strangers. He fled from the scene. He entered into the land of Midian. It's actually there that he met his future father-in-law, Jethro. And he had seven daughters. And they came and drew water and filled the troughs of the father's sheep. And he sees that these shepherds were molesting these girls. And he comes along, complete strangers, doesn't know who they are, and he feels bad for them. And he was a very powerful person. He was a young, powerful man who grew up in the palace. But there's a side point. The commentators say that Moses was the only person, we have discussed this in more detail, but I have to mention it now, who could save the Jewish people. I mean, mankind. Why? It's fascinating. Because Moses grew up in a palace, so he saw leadership. He saw the idea of power. The Jewish people, they were slaves. So make a slave into a leader. Once a slave, always a slave. There's going to be something missing. So one reason why Moses, well, we see retroactively, got his position in the palace, being brought up there, was that he could see true leadership, so he could take on the role of leadership. And one thing we'll see through history is that people that come from lower places and take on big positions of leadership, they're lacking something and can end up actually becoming great abusers of people because they themselves are abused. It's a common trait you see through world history. Not so the case of Moses. Moses was, and he was reluctant, as we will see. He took the responsibility. He did what he had to do in those three occasions. And maybe because of that, he merited to lead the Jewish people out of Egypt. And his great, obviously, personal conduct and midot and character. We'll speak about that as well. We're not impressed by leaders who are great leaders but treat the lower classes like dirt. We're not impressed by that. That is not a Jewish concept of leadership. But Moses saw great leadership, he followed it, and he treated others with great respect. So maybe these are the three things. And that is why we brought down a source of him from a book, The Leadership Qualities of Moses, of Moshe. Moshe is characterized as an individual who is incapable of standing idly by while injustice is being perpetrated. He couldn't handle it. That's who he was. That's who he was. He was someone, when he saw injustice, he had to do something about it. I'm going to go out on a limb and I'll say that that trait of Moshe Rabbeinu, of Moses, has passed down through our people. You can call it psychologically, sociologically, emotionally. I'm going to add spiritually that as well. That's who we are. You may have noticed that Jewish people always seem to be running the charities, starting charities, trying to help other people, give charity way out of proportion to their numbers. Right. Want to save the whale, save the penguin, save the planet. There's always a Goldberg, a Goldschmidt, who's like somewhere in there. It goes back. It's planted deep inside us. And he says that's despite the consequence he may face. He nonetheless feels obligated to an act to undo and correct the injustice. We are vehemently against injustice. One reason is that we started as slaves. And that's the reason we did start as slaves. So that we would not make other people slaves. God started our nation. Not as big. We didn't start as accountants and lawyers and business people. Right? Like, no. So we started humbly as slaves. One reason is so that we should realize that we should never make other people slaves. One of the reasons the rabbis bring down. And he became the right person in the right place where there were other men who were able to do it. And he recognized the situations. And that is why it says in Pirkei Avot, which is a collection of sayings by great sages, in a place where there are no leaders, strive to be a leader. If someone else is going to get the job done, that's okay. Don't do it because, oh, I feel like I'm a leader, I've got to do something. No. If there is a gap, if there is a place and you can add something, then you become a leader. Where was Moses chosen to be the leader of the Jewish people? Anybody know? Where was Moses? He was at the burning bush. The burning bush was where he was. All right, why it was a bush, why it was burning, is another discussion, whole discussion, what the bush represents, what the fire represents. That metaphor is very strong. But we'll leave that aside. He didn't want the job. He argued. Do you know how long he argued with God for? A week. 1 week of arguing with... Now, I don't know how you argue with God for a week. You know what I'm saying? And we all get upset sometimes. It may be a few seconds, a minute, an hour, but a week. Head on. Head on. Not the first time he argued with God, by the way. It's going to happen a few other times. He's going to do that. By the way, who did he want to become the leader of the Jewish people? Who did he suggest? His older brother, Aaron. That's correct. Because Aaron was the one who was there with the Jewish people in Egypt, in Mizraim. He was their quote-unquote chief rabbi. He was the obvious choice, and he wanted his older brother. He didn't want his older brother to hate him. He obviously thought he was a better person for it. God says, no, it's not for him, it's your job. He will have a great job. He'll become the high priest. Talk about him in future classes. He was also a great leader, as we'll see, in his own way, but not Moses. Moshe Rabbeinu's leadership level of leadership and clarity, of prophecy, was way above anybody else. Okay. So we're going to see that at the heart of Judaism, and I've listed this over here, there are three beliefs about leadership. According to Judaism, there are three beliefs that we have about leadership. Number one, we are free. We are free people. We have free will. We can decide. Even in the harshest of places, one person I'm going to focus on is someone who I greatly admire. I've yet to meet him, but I do plan to meet him one day. Anatoly Sharansky. Natan Sharansky. I read his two of his books, his autobiography, Fear No Evil. A lot of ideas of this course are going to come from him as well. He was a person who was not free. He was in a prison cell, in solitary confinement for years, for the heinous crime of teaching Judaism and Hebrew to some Jews in Russia. That was the crime. That was it. Okay. Gets married. She manages to escape to Israel, and he's then put into the gulag for a long time. And even he said that, and one quote, which I'm going to get exactly for you, is that although I was in solitary confinement, and they had me physically, they never had my spirit. I was a free person. Okay? And we're going to see more from him, an incredible person, who is still very active today. Number one, we're free. Okay? Number two, we are responsible. Right? That is a concept, as we saw already. Responsibility is the key trademark that we should have. And number three, and probably most important, is together we can change the world. Together, we can change the world. The world can change. It can become better. We are not pessimists, although this idea of Jews always complaining, always upset, oh, the eternal Jew is this terrible Nebuch. That is not the Judaism's view. It will get better, it can be better, and we can change it. Okay? I want to jump to a woman. It's been too male-centric, this class, so far. Let's come to one of the great Jewish leaders of Jewish history who had an unenviable task. Her name was Esther. Her real name was, anybody know? Hadassah is correct. Hadassah. Now, we see from her story, it's actually, if you look at it, it's an incredible story. First, it's just a fascinating read of what this woman went through. But it was highly, highly unpleasant. And that's why I give it as an example of taking responsibility, because that's still our theme now, principle one, is not always pleasant or easy. So just a quick 60-second what's up with the Purim story. The Jewish people had been exiled by Nebuchadnezzar with the destruction of the first temple. And the Jews were told they'd be in exile for 70 years. Problem was, they didn't know where the 70 years began and ended. Well, began, and ergo, where it ended. They found themselves, for the most part, in Persia, Paras, mostly in a city called Shushan, which is actually modern-day Hamadan, which is a city that still exists. And there was a Jewish leader who existed. His name was Mordechai, a great person and a prophet, and one of the leaders of the generation in the Great Assembly. And he had a cousin, a very, very beautiful woman. Different opinions how old she was. Some say she was very young. Some say she was in about 30s. Some say 40s, 50s, or maybe 60s. Different opinion how old she actually was. Okay, but we'll leave that aside. I know the image we have is some young princess, but may not be. And then it was Esther because she was hysterical. She was hidden. No one knew who she really was. Okay. So the whole story goes. He kills Vashti, this evil wife he had. Don't feel sorry for her. She was an evil anti-Semite. Caused a lot of pain and trouble to our people. And Achashverosh, the leader of the time, the subsequent dictator from Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar, kills his wife and now looks for another wife. And the way to do that is he kidnaps many women off the streets, young virgins, as well as having many of them actually volunteer because they want the job. Big opportunity of the queen of, the unfree world is a big thing, dictator's wife is not so bad. She was taken, and it builds up that there was an evil person called Haman, who is an anti-Semite par excellence, wants to wipe out the Jewish people. Ahasuerus agrees to allow Haman to kill the Jewish people, not knowing that Esther, his wife who he loves so much, is actually Jewish. And it comes in the middle of the story to a peak. People don't realize, they just read through the section, but there's actually a point right in the middle of the story where it actually peaks like this. And once it gets over that bump, it kind of, things start to go a little bit smoother. And the key point I want to point out to you, just to show the power of Esther and Mordechai, to be fair, is that Esther goes on a suicide mission. A suicide mission to go into Ahasuerus to tell him that she's Jewish. That's what she's going to do. So that's a very scary thing to do. One reason is because you have to get 30 days permission to speak to the king. But we'll leave that aside. What she's going to do, people don't realize, is a very scary thing. And Rabbi Shlomi Yitzchaki Rashi explains what her plan was. Her plan was to go into Ahasuerus and start to plant a seed in his mind that she and Haman were planning on getting rid of him and taking over the leadership. And there's nothing that scares a dictator more than people who are close to him, killing him, and taking over his position. Nothing scares them more to this very day. Distant people, not so bad. Close people, worse. People right next to your wife who's with you in bed at night, that freaks him out. So he starts to get very, very scared. Now, it's a suicide mission because he could turn around, shot Haman, or whatever the ancient equivalent was, and killed her as well. She takes a gamble, a risk. Before she does that, however, when Mordechai suggests she goes in, she says no. She says, you're crazy. I'm going to die. I didn't get permission. And the insinuation that I'm having this with is certain death. Look at the words inside. Mordechai replies to her, halfway down page 3, and says the following words. Do not imagine you will be able to escape in the king's palace any more than the rest of the Jews. If you persist in keeping silent at this time, relief and deliverance will come to the Jews from another place. And who knows, by the way, this is the kicker, my favorite line, and most people's favorite line in the Megillah, whether it was for such a time as this that you attained the royal position. What's he saying? Three things. Number one, if you don't step up, you're not going to escape. You're Jewish, it's going to get found you're Jewish, he'll kill them, he'll kill you. So don't think as you're some high and mighty, powerful leader right now, you're going to escape. Number one, don't rely on the safety of your leadership. Two, God will find someone else. The Jews are going to get saved. It's going to happen. And if it's not, you will find someone else. And it won't be Megillat Esther, it'll be Megillat Shoshana, Shirley, Barbara, whatever. But don't think the matter is dependent upon you. And here's the best part. Your life has come down to this moment. This is your mission. And now you've got to do it. If you don't grab it, you're missing out on your life's mission. A very scary concept. I mean, encoded in that is that people have a mission. In her case, one big mission. Maybe the rest of us is many of them. According to some commentators, I read 42, but we'll leave that aside. That you are going to have to do this job. It's your job. And she steps up, takes responsibility, and goes in. And sometimes, just like Esther, you have to jump. When the Jewish people were standing, this is at the creation of our nation, at the Reed Sea, also known as the Red Sea, could be either. So we read the story, Moses put his staff out and the sea split. But actually that's not exactly what happened, or only what happened. It says, Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, Hashem moved the sea with a strong east wind all night. He turned the sea to damp land, the water split. The Talmud says there's another character in the story we're not told about. And his name was Nachshon ben Aminadav. Nachshon, the son of Aminadav. And he was one of the leaders of the tribe of Judah, of Yehuda, one of the great tribes that actually we are, for the most part, all descendants of. And he heard Moses, and the people were scared. So he says, we've got to get the sea to split. So the Talmud tells us he jumped in. And the water was low. And he went in further, and he went up, 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 up. And eventually got to the point where it was up to his nose, which is pretty much death. At that moment, the sea split. That's what the Talmud tells us. What is that story? What is that? Who is this person? It's interesting that there's a... We went to a military base on our last trip to Israel. My last trip to Israel last summer, when I took a group out there, And this particular military base, the group of soldiers there, they are called the Nakhshan. Nakhshan Brigade. So I said, why choose Nakhshan? I said, we're the soldiers who go in first. That's what they call themselves. It's not just soldiers, it's us as well. You just have to jump. You just have to jump sometimes. And in the merit of Nakhshan ben Ammi Nadav, and he's considered a great hero for doing this, he showed, and the people saw him and said, if he could do it, we're in. And they went in as well, and they followed him. But he started the ball rolling. He took responsibility, and his merit is he split. I mean, it was Moses who did the splitting, with God's help, obviously. But it was Nakhshan ben Ammi Nadav who really got the job going. Sometimes, leadership is taking responsibility to get out of the way. That's your responsibility. There's a famous story of Bilam, Eov, and Yitro. Right? Bilam was an evil non-Jewish prophet. Eov was he of great suffering. Job, the book of Job, is Eov. And Yitro, Moses' father-in-law. And the Midrash tells us that all these three people were actually advisors to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh wanted to kill them. He wanted to put the Jewish male babies into the Nile. And he consulted with these great leaders. And Bilam said, kill him. Eov said nothing. And he was punished with great suffering. And Yitro ran away. And because of that, he merited to have children and grandchildren, great-grandchildren, became leaders of the Jewish people. Right? His daughter ended up marrying Moses. Sometimes, you have to know when to take responsibility by just getting out of the way. Okay, let's do principle number two. Principle number two is a very, very Jewish concept, obviously, which is no one can lead alone. Now, this may seem obvious to you, right? As you say in America, there's no I in team, but there is me. Just so you know. And if you look in the A, there is an I there as well. But we'll leave that aside. In Jewish thought, you cannot lead alone. And we learn that lesson very, very early on in the Torah from God. God. What happens? It says in the book of Genesis, chapter 1, verse 26, and God said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness. I mean, let us. God's making mankind. God's creating the world, the universe, and everything. Why would he let us? So the question is, who was God talking to when he said that? Rashi has that question. And Rashi says an incredible thing. It was the angels. God consulted with the angels, these spiritual beings, before he even created mankind. Rashi is perplexed by this. And said, one second. These angels didn't actually help in the creation of mankind. God just consulted them. And Rashi even says, and there's a problem. People may think there's two gods in the future. People may read this Torah and say, let us make man. You see, there's two gods, which is against the basic Jewish concept of one God, monotheism. And yet, God decided to use the idea of let us make man to teach a lesson that even if you don't even use those people to do what you're going to do, lead and create, you should consult. At least consult. And that lesson, according to Rashi and the Jewish commentators, was more important than the possible mistake of future people who say there's more than one God. That's how important this idea of one person cannot do it alone. And actually, it's all good, except when you lead alone. And that's obviously a discussion about marriage, because everyone who gets married becomes the leader of their family. And we see over there that man was created alone. And we hear in the book of Genesis, seven times you hear the word tov. Only twice in the Torah is the word lo tov, not good, written in the book of Genesis. And the first is when God says to mankind, it's not good for you to be alone. You need a partner in life. Okay? You need an Ezer Kenegdo, a helper who's opposing you. Could be there to push you and help you become great. Okay? And what's the goal? So you become one flesh. The second is when Jethro sees his son-in-law Moses leading alone, because Moses was the leader, and Yisro, turns around and says, that's not good. Two not goods. He says, what are you doing? You can't lead alone. Right? You can't live, and you can't lead alone. You need to have others. And what he ended up doing was choosing other great people to become judges among the Jewish people, and the power devolved for smaller cases to the... Because he was up all night. Jews were driving crazy. You can only imagine, right? I'm sure you can imagine. So two principles. You cannot live alone. You cannot lead alone. And Judaism, we see this. because we have, at least biblically speaking, three types of leader. And they are kings, malachim, priests, kohanim, and prophets, neviim. And each one of those had their own respective role. The king was a political leader. The priest was a religious leader. That's what their job really was, to lead spiritually. And the prophet was a visionary, a man or a woman of ideals and ideas. And Judaism leadership is an emergent property of multiple roles that are all in it together. Right? This balance of power, you call it in America, checks and balances. Have that expression, right? Between the three branches of government over here. See, I learned American political history in American history. It was a short course. But you get the idea. The idea of checks and balances between these roles. Each one has their own particular role. No one person or one group takes over the entire Jewish people. That is not the concept. Someone called me up today. You know, today, a pope was elected. So the idea is you have a pope. So someone said, what's the Jewish view of a pope? Right? Do we have a similar thing? Is the chief rabbi? And I said, you can't even compare it. First of all, the chief rabbi is, destroyed politically, right? It's a very tough, tough job. Ask any chief rabbi. We have a chief rabbi in England. But he doesn't lead, he guides, he advises. Right? And there's a little some leadership quality as well to who the chief rabbi is as well. But the pope, he's meant to see he's a direct connection to God. That is not a Jewish concept. That is not a Jewish concept. Everyone is meant to find their own personal connection. And that's why King Solomon, one of the greatest Jewish leaders, actually Jewish history, we'll see more and hear more from him. He wrote a lot about it, and he went through great difficulty. Spoke of this idea of teammanship when it comes to leading. And he says two, as in the book of Kehelet, two are better than one. For if they fall, the one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him that he is alone when he falls, if he has not to pick him up. And as we're going to see, King Solomon was speaking from experience. He led at the greatest time of Jewish history. Right? The construction of the first temple is actually seen to be one of the greatest times of Jewish history we've ever known, of great unity. And it was also there when he saw the breakdown of Jewish history as well. So he knew the most of what he was talking about. We'll be looking at a lot of his words and ideas as well as we travel through this course. Those are our first two principles out of 10 of Jewish leadership. Thank you so much. Any questions or thoughts or comments would be appreciated.